Hey everybody, before we get started, I just wanted to jump on because we are so excited to announce that Restore registration is officially open. We can't wait to be with you again this year. It's going to be on September 5th through 7th at the Mountain America Expo Center in Sandy, Utah. That's the evening of September 5th and then all day on the 6th and the 7th. 3 days of incredible speakers, poets, musicians, and artists. We really think that what we have planned will blow you away again this year, so you won't want to miss it. Go to faithmatters.org/restore for tickets and we'll see you there. Hey everybody, this is Aubrey Chavez from Faith Matters. It can be a beautiful experience sometimes to sit back and listen to two great minds musing on some of the biggest questions of life. Even when their conversations feel a bit beyond our grasp, they point to deeper realms and invite us to journey with them into a richer intellectual life. That's exactly what we have for you today. Two of the great intellectuals in the Latter-day Saint world, Terrell Givens and John Durham Peters, invite us to drop in on a conversation between good friends, a conversation that ranges across a variety of fascinating topics. John Durham Peters is a professor of English and professor of film and media studies at Yale University. A media historian and social theorist, he authored the acclaimed book, Speaking Into the Air, A History of the Idea of Communication. His other books include Courting the Abyss and The Marvelous Clouds. We hope that you enjoy this episode.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Terrell Givens, sponsored by Faith Matters. I am here with one of my beloved friends and an academic whom I just highly admire and love talking to because he has such a lively and engaging mind. His name is John Durham Peters. He's the Maria Rosa Menocal Professor of English and of
Film. Menocal. It's
Menocal. Okay.
Yeah.
The Menocal Professor of English and of Film and Media Studies at Yale. That's fairly recent, right? You've been there just a few years. You came from
4.5 years. Yeah.
4.5 years, that long. Came from an endowed chair at Iowa. We can't seem to arrange ourselves so that we're on the same half of the continent at the same time. But he's, well, as I mentioned, expert in media studies. You're quite prolific. You've written a number of books, some of which I have read more thoroughly than others. I myself was deeply influenced and moved by, I think it was your first book, 1999, Speaking Into the Air, a kind of history of communication, but a lot more interesting and engaging than that category can sound to some people outside of media studies. And then you did another one on Courting the Abyss. That was a few years later. And then you did The Marvelous Clouds, which got a lot of fanfare for its ambitious history of everything that you've managed to subsume within the rubric of media. And then most recently, just last year, you did Promiscuous Knowledge, which you kind of co-wrote with your friend Kenneth Camille. And I'm working my way through that one, but it's a...
Really?
Yes, I am.
Wow. You're in a rare group.
And it's a...
Do not publish a book in March 2020.
Yeah, that's, well, one would have thought maybe that people didn't have anything else to do except read during these days of COVID. But so we're going to be talking today about a range of topics. You are generally referred to in reviews as a polyglot. You're in media studies, you kind of do intellectual history, you do some philosophy, you manage to weave theology into much of what you do. And so I'm hoping to maybe intersect with many of those boundaries today.
Mormonism contains all truth.
There you
go. I read that as a teenager with Brigham Young, and I thought, let's do this thing.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing I love about your interview style. I'm thinking, for example, of the LA Times review, which was a quite extensive review of your book, The Marvelous Clouds. And the way you introduce Mormonism and Mormon theology into the conversation, it's never gratuitous. It's never forced or evangelistic. You have a very sincere and well-rooted way of seeing Mormon theology as interconnected with so many other disciplines and ideas. And I noticed that in the LA Times and elsewhere, they often don't pick up the ball and run with it.
Right. Yeah, they don't.
They just pass that over in silence and go on to the next question.
Is that a lateral? No, that was a fumble.
So, gee, there's so many places we could start for a point of departure, but I'm going to just pick one kind of arbitrarily. Can I do that?
Right.
That comes out of your LA Times interview.
And LA Review of Books, yeah.
I'm sorry, LA Review of
Books. No worries, yeah.
And a theme that you tend to go back to occasionally, I think this was an important part of your speaking into the air, was an attempt to kind of demystify or deromanticize a lot of our ideas about the past. And then that book about communication and interrelatedness and romantic love. And you kind of come back to that theme in this recent book, insofar as, you know, everybody's writing books about the technology glut and, you know, the information deluge. You set yourself apart by taking rather novel approaches to a tired theme. And one way you do that is evident in these words. So I'm just going to read a few sentences from your interview. You say, the philosophy of technology is often infected by a romanticism that sees technology as a loss of an elemental relation to the cosmos, that we tend to be deluded with conceptions of original purity. And then you ask, why would we want to go back to Eden? Living in a world rich with objects and subjects is a step forward, an opportunity, especially if we embrace the covenants that moor our sometimes errant ship. Here, my Mormonism, you say, with its materialist metaphysics, media-friendly theology, affirmation of this worldly embodiment as a step toward divinity, and rigorous sense of responsibility for choice, surely shines through my philosophy of technology. So I'd love to hear, I mean, I've read a good bit on it, but I'd love to hear you talk about this a bit more for our audience. Because you're not infatuated with technology in the way that, you know, many of the millennials are just kind of, you know, addicted to it. So what do you mean? How might we reevaluate our relationship to technology and its role in our lives?
Great, great question. You know, the epigraph to The Marvelous Clouds is Alma 37:6, which I don't know if anybody, it's also an epigraph. There's the epigraph from Emerson. There are two epigraphs from my two favorite books from the 1830s, basically. That God works by means. Means are media. So what would it mean if we took seriously the idea that God uses techniques or technologies? And for me, this contrast is important, actually, because I do think that technique is something which is primordial in human being and perhaps divine being, that we need help, that we're materially embedded in environments. We are placed in that sphere to act freely. You know, according, you know, from section 93, why wouldn't a divine life also be one of means? Technology, I think, is something different because it necessarily implies a kind of gadget, you know, a kind of material quality. And this is why in chapter two of that book, The Marvelous Clouds, they talk about whales and dolphins who are presumably highly intelligent and presumably full of techniques of politicking and singing and you know, raising families and ethics and so on, but without technologies because their world prohibits any kind of engineering, any kind of infrastructural engineering. So, yeah.
So part of what you're doing is you broaden definitions in a way. Yeah. Sometimes people push back, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Like The Marvelous Clouds. Nobody thinks of clouds as a form of media. And so correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that what you're doing is to say, well, there are at least two different ways that meaning can be constituted. One is through intentionality, a kind of system of signs we engage in self-consciously, but that other natural phenomena we also interpret because they have meanings. They are pointers to the future, to other realities.
Right. Yeah, we can read that which was never written. I mean, there's a lot to read out there. I mean, books are written, but so are clouds, so are leaves, so is the history of the cosmos. And, you know, if we, you know, Charles Sanders Peirce is a thinker who's very important to me. And, you know, he talks about continuity, in which he basically thinks there's a continuity of intelligence from what he calls slime mold, or in other words, protoplasm, up to God. And this just resonates very, very deeply with me. Maybe it's reading Orson Pratt as a teenager or something but that sort of panpsychist idea that objects are imbued and alive with intelligence, and that the whole world is sort of, I mean, this is Walter Benjamin's metaphor, but the whole world is mute because of the fall. It should be singing, but we still have to figure out how to translate it. You know, we have to understand how to read the cosmos, and that this is part of our, you know, Section 88 is full of this kind of suggestion, of course, you know, that the earth rolls upon its wings.
Yeah, and there's been a striking turn in this direction, hasn't there, on the part of philosophers and cosmologists and theorists of consciousness? I'm thinking of Thomas Nagel. I'm thinking of Stuart Kaufman, and others who are suggesting that matter seems to follow certain principles of self-organization.
Yeah,
that there seems to, if not, you know, fully sentience or consciousness, but there is some kind of intelligence at work that seems to be moving in the direction of always greater intelligence, a greater kind of amalgam
of
these elements.
Yeah.
So,
Peirce's great word is evolutionary love, which is a direct attack upon the kind of social Darwinist or social Manchesterian or Spencerian. Sorry, this is all, I'm teaching a class in the 19th century next semester, so this is all in my head.
Yeah.
But the kind of brutal reading of Darwin, Peirce says, no, you know, let's think about evolutionary love. Let's think about the highest achievement of evolution as thirdness, as connection, as interpretation, connection, love.
So that kind of corresponds rather nicely with certain ideas in the King Follett discourse, right?
Very much so.
That's the point of the song. So tell me, how does your project, how is it influenced by and how is it different from the kind of 19th century project of natural theology that also wants to read all of creation as kind of emblematic of God and his nature?
Yeah, such a good question, because, you know, I'm torn somewhere between someone like Charles Babbage, who has this amazing treatise, a theological treatise from 1838, in which he basically says that the whole universe, even the air, is a library of everything that's ever happened. You know, he's been reading, he's buddies with Laplace, the mathematician, and he believes in infinitesimal vibrations, and such that we could actually, if we could travel fast enough and far enough, we could reconstruct the eye of omniscience, is his idea, that we could reconstruct everything that happened. So Babbage on the one side, Herman Melville on the other side, with Moby Dick, and in which it's sort of, you know, the universe may have a meaning, but who's the person in that novel who really wants to figure out what the universe means? It's Ahab. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's a sort of frantic, manic quest, and he thinks he's got it figured out, and that there's a kind of, you know, looming malevolence in the cosmos embodied in the white whale. And, you know, Ishmael, the narrator of Moby Dick, of course, is much more agnostic. And, you know, so, you know, that agnosticism seems really quite appealing in many ways. I mean, it's Alma with Korihor. I mean, you know, the Alma's evidences, which he offers, are not ones which are totally binding. They're ones which require the will and the interpretive fortitude, or the interpretive will, I guess, is the right word, of the reader. So, yeah, I guess I'm stuck somewhere between the universe singing out in all of its glory and the sort of ultimate breakdown of our ability to read it well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me see if I can pull a couple of these threads together to pose another question. It seems to me like Emerson is a profound influence
on
your thinking as well. And I'm thinking, too, of his, what I thought was a brilliant, in his essay on nature, a brilliant kind of critique of this false dichotomy between nature and civilization, right? Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. Are we doing anything different when we build a skyscraper than a beaver is when it builds its lodge, right? So there's a kind of collapse of those polarities, which is also related to his critique also of a kind of, you know, faux primitivism, this sense mm-hmm. that we want to get back to this pristine purity before civilization despoiled it. Now, I want to see if I can put this into a kind of theological context, right? Mm-hmm. Because it seems that part of what you're resisting here is a kind of typically Calvinist outlook on life as a kind of undeviating declension from a primordial innocence. And it seems to me that you're combining both a kind of evolutionary outlook with a kind of Mormon, right, forward-looking, theosis-oriented kind of modality to suggest that I don't want to put words in your mouth because I'm all, you know, it's already pretty well known that this is part of my project. But would I be correct in saying that part of what you're trying to do as well is to divest us of a kind of Protestant overlay to the way we read history that you think works in negative ways?
Yeah, I mean, there is no primal purity. We come into the world technical beings, social beings, connected beings. So the idea, but I don't know. And I'm still thinking about Calvinism and if that fits or not. And I'll give a brief historical point. I went on my mission in the Netherlands. And so I spent part of it in deeply Catholic territory. And the typical answer we would get when we knocked on people's door was, "Ik ben Katholikus," which means something like, "I'm Catholic, so go away," or Catholic. And we were appalled. And this was our sort of, you know, Mormon Protestantism coming through, that they wouldn't know or care about their theology, you know, that they wouldn't see this as a kind of literate intellectual project. But then I got transferred to the Calvinist zone. And I mean, this was really, really intense. And I didn't know which one I liked better or liked worse. But the other thing I was going to say is, one of my favorite authors is a Calvinist. You probably like her too, Marilynne Robinson.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
She's
not really a Calvinist.
She says she's a Calvinist, but her whole point is to try to redeem Puritanism from its slur of being anti-worldly, anti-natural, anti-embodied, anti-pleasure. I don't know. I mean, these categories are tricky, but I mean, absolutely. I lose interest really fast when I hear people whinging about, you know, why can't we just go back to Eden? I mean, I just have this like reflex that I can't stop myself from.
There's another interesting theological intersection here that I think you're contesting, and that is, you know, we have an article of faith that talks about, we believe in the same organization that existed in the primitive church, right? And so I'd much rather talk about, we believe in the same impulses and inclinations that existed in the primitive church. I think those are far more important. But we tend to overread that article of faith, don't we? And so that's part of what creates not just a sentimental, but a theological nostalgia for a past that never existed.
Right.
Because the church wasn't as full-blown and developed. And, you know, my favorite contemporary theologian is probably David Bentley Hart. And
really?
Who can be, he can be incredibly caustic.
Yes, he's Mr. Caustic.
Yeah, all theological values matter to him except kindness. But but he's written recently on this theme where he says we have to move beyond this. In fact, I just happened to have this. I posted it on my wall. I like it so well. So can I just read some of this and then have you comment on this? He said, "The configuration of the old Christian order is irrecoverable. And in many ways, that is for the best. But the possibilities of another, perhaps radically different Christian social vision remain to be explored and cultivated." In its first, he says, "Christian thought can always return to the apocalyptic novum of the event of the gospel in its first beginning, and drawing renewed vigor from that inexhaustible source, imagine new expressions of the love it is supposed to proclaim to the world, and new ways beyond the impasses of the present." See, it seems to me that when Joseph Smith uses the word restoration, right? And to this day, you find many religious historians who categorize Mormonism as a restorationist tradition, in the tradition of Campbell and Stone and others. And I think nothing could be further from the truth, because typical restorationism was all about reduction. We go back, we strip, we refine. And Joseph Smith was, no, we go forward, we expand, we add. And so I'm just happy to hear you express these kinds of thoughts, because it seems to me to give added emphasis to the need to shift our focus forward rather than backward in these nostalgic ways. So
nostalgia is a trap, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it can be paralyzing, and you know, it's counterproductive, I think, to the project of a continuing restoration.
Right. I mean, my favorite absurd example is Nephi on the tower in Helaman, which he says, "If I could only have lived in the days of Lehi and Nephi." Come on. He obviously didn't read the text, or didn't read it very well. Exactly. Maybe he didn't have access to the small plates. I don't know.
It seems to me there's a parallel theme here too, then, that has to do with how exactly do we envision that future? So it seems that as Mormons, we're kind of caught between Scylla and Charybdis, because on the one hand, we look back and we get all nostalgic and sentimental, and we look forward and we get all apocalyptic and horrified by the specter of this destruction. And you've written that you think we may need to rethink exactly what our vision of the end time, the end game should be. So can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a couple directions I want to go, because in the past year and a half, we've all been involved in reckonings of various kinds, in which you have a kind of reverse nostalgia, in which we're able to see the past as a kind of iniquitous DNA, which continues to determine us. So, I mean, that's something I'd be interested in thinking about a bit. In the book that I'm trying to write, but not really writing, it's about weather and it's about climate. And, you know, one of the questions is, are there other ways of thinking about climate change that are besides the apocalyptic? Because apocalypse, as you well know, is a literary genre, which comes together with certain kinds of expectations and themes, in the same way that, you know, the genres we tend to use for thinking about the future tend to be apocalypse, or especially the future of climate change, or pastoral, or tragedy. Could we think comedy? You know, comedy is about regeneration. You know, and The Marvelous Clouds does end with a kind of dark comedy in saying, you know, that, you know, we humans may not exist anymore, but the planet's going to keep chugging. You know, so I mean, there is going to be, you know, whatever happens, there's going to be some kind of new forms of life. You know, the cockroaches are going to survive. They can survive anything. So, I mean, there's, I don't know, what are the genres we can use to think about the future? And what are the theological tools that we have to think about really complicated pasts? Because, you know, this nation and this church has been doing a lot of work to think about its past. And I'm not sure that we're always doing it very productively.
Yeah. Well, this may take us down a detour we don't want to go, but you raised in my mind the question of transhumanism. You know, it's been noted by more than one person that Latter-day Saints seem to be the only religious denomination that is represented to a significant degree among transhumanist communities and organizations, right? And so for those who don't know what we mean by transhumanism, maybe you could go ahead and fill in a definition there. But I'm just wondering what with the kind of revisionist appreciative approach you take to technology and media, how would you identify yourself relative to transhumanist kind of impulse?
I think I'm skeptical because it seems that part of, I mean, not that I understand it well enough. I was invited to speak at one of their conferences and that got canceled because of COVID. But, you know, I think finitude is absolutely essential, that mortality is a gift. And as I understand transhumanism, it's that we should mobilize the wonderful tools that we have, whether to prolong or even find eternal life. And, you know, death, I think we have to kind of embrace. The Marvelous Clouds ends with Socrates, Jesus, and Confucius. as the, my three heroes, all of whom refused to write, all of who refused a certain kind of technology, a technology of prolongation, of extension of life, and nonetheless lived on because of the work of their disciples. I mean, all their message was all, don't fear death. And so, this may not be fair to transhumanism, and Tamara Kinese and my son Benjamin Peters have actually written a really interesting piece about Mormon transhumanism, so that they know more.
Okay. Well, what you've said just brings to mind another marvelous, provocative statement of yours. It just happens to be absolutely apropos what you just said. You said, you know, many have written on the danger of cognitive deterioration, right? We're so reliant now on forms of technology, we don't have to learn much for ourselves. Google is an extension of the brain. And then you say, but something more insidious, a kind of existential deorientation is at work, in which presumptions of universal storage alter our relation to loss and death. So you remind me in saying that of a statement made by an atheist friend of mine once. We were talking in collegial conversation about the possibility of life after death. And he said, well, I think that one has to believe in the absolute finality of death to give any value to the life that is bookended.
Yeah.
That way. So I see there's a kind of logic to that. Mm. And yet I wonder, does anybody really believe that?
Really? There's Martin Hägglund up there. This Life makes that precise argument. I don't know if you know this book, my Yale colleague.
I don't. Yeah. Well, you seem to be not going quite that far. But
no.
But you're saying something like that, right? Something that approaches that. In that there's the necessity to recognize our finitude,
right,
in a way that puts more value on the transient and the provisional. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, who knows what's beyond the grave? I love walking around cemeteries. There's a lot in New Haven, and finding funny gravestones. I found one that said stone. I found one that said Mortel, but my favorite one was one that said Wer weiß. This was this was, if you pronounce the way, it wasn't exactly two words like in German, but in German that means who knows.
Right.
And I thought that, you know, Thomas Hobbes said, you know, famously that the gravestone is the ultimate philosopher's stone. You know, and that we, you know, and Hannah Arendt, of course, said, let's not think about death, let's think about birth, a kind of great, you know, feminist or proto-feminist rejoinder to the boy philosopher's obsession with death. But, you know, there's something sweet about finitude. I mean, there's that old Scott Card story about the aliens who come around and hang around cemeteries because they find it so beautiful that these mortals can die because they're stuck. You know, they can't die.
Yeah. Let me shift gears just a little bit. We have just a few minutes left, and I want you to speak to what I thought were some of your more profound and transformational insights in terms of the way they affected my relationships that come from speaking into the air. And it's where you demythologize romantic love, right? I think as a young starry-eyed teenager or post-teenager, right? I always thought there was something beautiful about the Latter-day Saint conception of eternal marriage that posited in Erastus Snow's vocabulary, right? A kind of existential combinatorial, right, essence that you come to constitute as a man and woman. You become a new being, mm-hmm. not beings. And that notion of becoming completely one, completely united, right? I think probably wasn't the healthiest way in which to enter a marriage relationship, because one or the other has to submit, right? And so you give a very different account of love across difference. Can you just say a few things about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, marriage itself done right is the great critique of romantic love, because it takes you to something better. I love the word cleave. Cleave unto.
Yeah.
Cleave means to divide, and it means to join. And I think that's the great word for marriage, because it's precisely, I mean, it's the scandal of difference, which can seem so agonizing when there's some kind of misunderstanding. You know, it can seem like this eternal gulf between hearts. And, you know, the poets have been lamenting that forever. But on the other hand, what a cacophony would be if we had to listen to each other's half-baked thoughts before they were filtered through language and reflection and reason and kindness and so on. So, I mean, this idea that, you know, telepathy, you know, a kind of instantaneous fusion of our hearts would be a good thing. No, thank you. I don't want my stupid, unfiltered thoughts. I mean, it's hard enough. I mean, James is great on this, the book of James, you know, that the tongue is so unruly. You know, I've said stuff which were not properly filtered, and I've lived to regret it in marriage and in other ways. And if I didn't have that shield of processing my being through the materiality of embodiment and language and existence and time and, you know, the household flow and all the things that we're engaged in, that makes marriage much richer, I think.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, dreaming of you know, a Vulcan mind melt. I mean, heaven forbid. I don't want Dr. Spock right. extracting, mining all of my deep dark thoughts.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as long as you call that a sentimental view of love, yeah. and not a romantic view of love, because that's and you mean romantic in the colloquial sense, right? Because, you know, in romanticism itself, right, there's this interesting critique of that I think underlies the prevalence of the theme of incest, right? It's as if what they're saying is, if you keep projecting yourself onto the other, that's ultimately what you're tending towards. So you see it in Mary Shelley, and you see it in Lord Byron, and you see it in Chateaubriand, you see it everywhere.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they were conscious of that, but at some level, I think they were saying, no,
yeah,
difference is essential to this healthy.
I mean, Hegel in his Phenomenology, you might remember this passage when he's saying that the love of brother and sister is the highest form.
No, I
don't. because it lacks desire.
Right.
Because there is no desire there. And then he starts riffing on Antigone, of course. Right. Which was the great drama of the 19th century. Yeah. Oedipus is the great drama of the 20th century. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's clear that the romantics are actually much smarter than we give them credit for being. I mean, they're the ones who recognize that this is all, it's all breaking down, and they make poetry out of it. I mean, that's the great lesson. You discover breakdown, you don't mope.
Yeah.
You make poetry. You write an ode to dejection. You just don't go moping around. Yep. You do something with it. That's a lesson for us as married or as humans connected with other humans. I mean, you know, marriage is maybe the most intense form, but certainly not the only.
Right. Well, I love your image of difference is what creates the gap across which the spark can ignite. Right. And yeah, that became really pivotal. So thank you for that. John, you have any concluding thoughts before we wrap up? Anything that we've left unsaid that you wish we had addressed?
I want to talk about my talk about the Constitution.
All right. If we get cut off, we won't get cut off, but let's give it a try. I think we've got 5 minutes left.
Just a member of the bishopric invited me to give a talk, essentially a 4th of July talk, the last Sunday of June on the Constitution, and assigned me some reading from President Oakes. And, you know, there are a bunch of discoveries, but the main discovery was we officially believe the Constitution to be an inspired document. And yet the Constitution was a profoundly flawed document because it endorsed slavery. It actually awarded money via taxation and representation to slave states, and it excluded women from voting. So race and gender, two of the great sins that our nation has been involved in. And yet, how do we recognize that to have been inspired? And I think this discovery that inspiration does not preclude imperfection, which may not even be a strong enough word, like, you know, grotesque, you know, abuse, you know, I mean, there's no other word that for that than slavery. How could that be inspired? And I think that to me is a really rich way of a kind of applying an atonement theology to think about history and the crimes of history. Because, you know, I recently read Isabel Wilkerson on Caste, which is a very compelling read, but all of her metaphors are determinist. It's DNA, it's botanical. You know, whatever happened with slavery is still happening now. You know, and it's compelling, but I also think that, you know, there are other ways of thinking about the past as amnesty without amnesia, to use the famous words of Adam Michnik, the Polish journalist and political theorist. So anyway, there are lots of directions we could go. We don't have time, but I think this is quite fruitful in terms of thinking about the church's very complicated racial, racist past.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I mean, we can book another conversation.
Okay, maybe we'll do that because the comment that you made in passing that deserves an hour itself is how this ties to the atonement, and that the atonement can substantively change the past.
Exactly.
That's the whole infinitude of, it seems to me, right, the atonement as it has
capacity. It changes the past and it binds the future. I mean, that's the, we think of the future as open-ended, we think of the past as fixed, and right, the atonement flips that. That's one of the many marvels of it.
Right. Well, John, I'm definitely going to have you back. And
okay.
Appreciate
maybe in person. Who knows?
I hope so. But thanks so much for spending your time with us today.
Well, it was a real pleasure. Thanks for such great questions and kind words. And thanks for the great work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. We hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Taro Givens and John Durham Peters. As always, if Faith Matters content is resonating with you and you get the chance, we would love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen on. We read every review and so appreciate the way it helps us to get the word out about Faith Matters. Thanks again for listening, and remember, you can check out more at faithmatters.org.